According to the NHS, 1 in 11 people over the age of 65 are living with dementia. Those figures rise to 1 in 6 people when it's over the age of 80. According to Alzheimer's UK's 2024 statistics, over 850,000 people are living with dementia, and those numbers are looking to rise to 2 million by the year 2050. With an increasingly ageing demographic in our churches, those statistics are likely to be real people in your church, bringing you face to face with the challenges of supporting and bringing spiritual care to the elderly in your church and community. Today I'm speaking with Debbie Thrower from Anna Chaplaincy. Debbie is a former broadcaster. You might recognise her from presenting Songs of Praise, BBC Radio 2, Radio 4 and ITV's Meridian Tonight in the South. She's an Anglican licensed lay minister and was the first Anna Chaplain for Older People in Alton in 2010. Debbie joined BRF Ministries in 2014 to develop a national network of chaplains offering spiritual care in later life. There are now 358 Anna Chaplains, plus many more volunteer Anna friends across the UK. Anna Chaplains are named after the widow Anna, who appears with Simeon in Luke's Gospel to bless the infant Jesus. Both are good role models of faithful older people. Anna chaplains are trained to offer spiritual care for older people, supporting them emotionally and spiritually, whether they have strong, little, or no faith at all. Today we're talking to Debbie about how our churches can become dementia-friendly spaces. Thanks for joining us on the Roots for Churches podcast. Here we go. Welcome, Debbie. It's great to have you on the Roots for Churches podcast. I'm delighted to talk to you. Can you start us off by telling us a bit of your story? How did you end up interested in this area of spiritual care for the elderly?
Well, it's as much a surprise to me as it is to anybody else, I can tell you. But my parents, who have now sadly died, they aren't around, but I think they'd be amazed that the ups and downs of their own aging process have really led to the establishment of Anna Chaplaincy for Older People. I had a bit of a masterclass in the difficulties of growing old in the 21st century because they encountered a lot of complex medical problems and psychological problems. And when I first heard about a chaplaincy for older people, I thought, first of all, oh, that's exactly what my mum and dad could have done with. Why aren't these everywhere? So as soon as I saw a job advert for a chaplain for older people, community-based, I thought, these really ought to be all over the country. But I didn't think for a moment that I would have anything to do with it. But having seen the job advert, this was in Alton in Hampshire, not far from where I'm speaking to you now. My home is in Hampshire between Winchester and Alton. I applied. I was the only applicant for this role. But the churches, the combination of both Anglicans and Methodists who were offering this job opportunity, a paid half a week post, they hoped that whoever applied would really design and shape a community-based chaplaincy that would reach people who were struggling to live independently, as well as those who were living in care homes and in sheltered accommodation. And so it was really up to me to decide how to spend my time, where to put the emphases. And I remember in the job interview, they said to me, we want you to spot the gaps and to raise the whole standard of good practice in this area. So no pressure, but it was a wonderful opportunity. And I could see that actually there are real difficulties in growing old in our society today. We place so much emphasis on youth, beauty, productivity. We understandably guard our autonomy very jealously as we grow older. The last thing any of us want to be is a burden on anybody else. But the actual fact is that we are sociable beings who are made to be interdependent. And just as children need a lot of help and coaxing in their first formative years, so as we grow more frail in our more vulnerable older age, we need to be dependent upon others and interdependent. But that's not to say that we don't have masses of life experience and wisdom and opportunities to contribute if we'll only be given those opportunities. And that sadly is what is sad. It was very often lacking, I think, in our society.
And the challenge of families living much further apart. I know my mum lives in America, you know, quite far. And my husband's family, they live an hour and a half drive. I think that must be common of many, many families. So families just not nearby.
Of course it is.
And so how do you do that?
There are some families who are very lucky that they live next door to mum and dad and the extended family is close by. And that's an enviable situation. It brings its own challenges, of course. But by and large, many of us now have siblings, parents, grandparents, great-grandparents who live some distance away. And that does leave them in their older age quite vulnerable. And yeah, it places a great stress too sometimes on younger family members who have caring responsibilities. Yeah, it's a different situation than it was, say, 50 or 100 years ago, certainly.
So tell me more about how Anna Chaplaincy developed. You were working in Alton, you were pioneering this role. How did it grow into what it is today?
Well, because I'm a broadcaster, I spent 30-odd years working in print journalism, then in radio and television. So I've got these kind of, you know, such as they are, communication skills. And I suppose it was natural that I would write about it, that I would end up speaking about it, that people would invite me to a village hall and say, please tell us, you know, what is this Anna Chaplaincy? What's distinctive about it? What's new? How can we develop something similar where we are? So after 3 or 4 years, it became apparent to me that I needed a website. I needed an infrastructure. I needed a team. And as I said, right from the very start, I knew that this was a replicable model. If we could develop something really that worked in Alton, and that developed very quickly, it was clear to me that it would work in remote village locations, in suburbs, or in inner cities. And that's what's proved to be the case. And now, of course, we're part of BRF Ministries. I knew they'd had a huge success with Messy Church, growing it so that it's on every continent across the globe. And I thought if we could get a fraction of the success of that for Anna Chaplaincy in the UK, although we get a lot of inquiries from America, New Zealand, Australia, at the moment we only have the money to really develop it nationally in the UK. But it's going very, very well indeed.
So Anna Chaplaincy is sort of a hub for best practice, for training for those who want to care for the elderly?
It absolutely is. What surprised me and my colleagues is that there is no shortage of people who are developing, like me, a vocation to do this sort of work. Some have been youth and children's workers years ago and now really want to be working at the other end of the age spectrum with older people. We've got midwives who have had a caring profession in the health service and now find in their retirement that this is exactly what they want to do. They've got such good pastoral skills, such broad life experience that there are transferable skills from many different careers. So there are teachers, social workers, people who've worked in all sorts of different health service roles who are finding a new lease of life, often in their early retirement years when they've got bags of energy, lots of desire to give back and to have meaning and purpose in their own lives. So men as well as women can be Anna Chaplains. And it's fascinating to see people who are physiotherapists are now Anna Chaplains because they've got great people skills. And being a good listener is the one real quality that you need in order to be a successful Anna Chaplain. Lots of other things as well, good emotional awareness, spiritual intelligence. We're all Christians, but we're, of course, talking to people of all faiths, little faith, no faith at all. And that's what makes it such an interesting and varied career for people.
Well, that's fantastic. It's great to hear how just the seed of faith and a faithfulness to God has grown into something that God is multiplying and using across the country. Today, specifically, we want to talk about dementia. And I wondered if you could give us sort of a layman's terms definition. What is dementia? We have all these other terms that float around, Alzheimer's, you know, just forgetfulness in old age. What defines dementia?
Well, dementia is a general term, an umbrella term, if you like, for many different conditions. There are literally scores of different types of dementia. But all of them have in common this sense of loss of memory, very often a loss of capacity to make key decisions, a loss of spatial awareness. So sometimes one of the first indications is getting lost and really not knowing where you are. Now, this is not the same as occasionally losing your car keys, or even, dare I say it, going into a multi-story car park and realizing you're on the wrong floor, you're looking in the wrong place for your car.
Happens to us all.
This is quite normal. Happens to us all. But it's quite different when people are actually heading towards a diagnosis of dementia. Yes, it's about memory loss, but it varies from label to label. But the most, common and recognizable form of dementia is described as Alzheimer's disease, named after Dr. Alzheimer. So there are others, though, vascular dementia, Lewy body dementia, and so on. And then there are conditions like CJD, mad cow disease, as the media dubs it, where dementia is a feature of that disease, but it's much more complex than that. Dementia is not a normal part of the aging process. So many people think, you know, just forgetfulness happens to everybody. We're all on a spectrum of forgetfulness. You know, many of us can remember quite easily what we did in our childhood, but not necessarily when someone says, what did you do at the weekend? And your mind goes a bit blank. What did I do last weekend? But that's quite normal. What isn't normal is the kind of brain condition which results in many people with dementia having what are known as plaques and tangles. So that they're actually kind of deposits on the neural circuitry in our brains, which just stops those synapses firing in the way that they always used to. And that can result in severe memory loss and as I said, inability to make key decisions, and also a sort of skewed visual perception. We've heard sometimes that people go into churches, and if there's a big black mat, someone with dementia might perceive that black mat to be a hole that they're about to step into, a void. So one has to be very careful about designing features in our church buildings and in public buildings generally, so that they are dementia-friendly for people and they're not going to be off-putting the people who are suffering from this kind of brain disease.
Is it preventable? I mean, the statistics seem like it's quite common, but not everybody gets this.
No, not everybody gets it, and many people don't, so one shouldn't be too fearful of it. But there are risk factors. Cardiovascular disease, heart disease is one of the big ones. Being obese is another considerable risk factor. It's interesting that education, those who have a very low level of education, who've never really learnt the ability to pay attention well, seem to succumb to dementia more easily than others. It's shown some quite interesting research in a book that I've just finished reading, actually, called Dodging Dementia, talking about the many risk factors, has said that a reasonably good level of education is quite a protective factor in not developing dementia, because the ability to pay attention actually is very key in all of this. But also, you know, not abusing alcohol, not taking too many either illegal drugs or indeed prescribed medical drugs. Sometimes people are taking such a cocktail of different things that they have side effects and interreactions which can be harmful, and they can trick people into dementia in a way that perhaps if they weren't taking so many medicines that conflict, would not be the case.
It does seem that societally then there will be pockets where there is more dementia, which may be linked to people's economic and social experience. And so you may have communities and churches where there is a lot more dementia than you would expect in sort of a general demographic.
That might well be the case. And even in people who don't get to church, there might be loneliness and social isolation, which certainly contributes. It's this lack of stimulus that I was talking about, that if we live in communities where we're regularly in conversation with people, we belong to different groups and societies, we've got leisure interests that involve us in relating regularly with other people, all of that is going to keep the brain circuitry working well. And where that's not happening, then there is a risk that, you know, overeating can happen. Depression can kick in. If you are that awful term, a shut-in, you've probably heard that term, where somebody closes the front door after going shopping and they know that they won't be seeing another human being for another week or more in some cases. And in some dreadful situations, people die and nobody knows for months, even sometimes years later, that a body is there. Those are the really tragic cases, but that's the worst case scenario. But for all of us, it's important as we age to keep connected with other people, because it's good for our mental health, our physical health, and our general well-being.
And our spiritual health, I would argue, as well.
Of course, of course. And that's why it's so sad that sometimes when people develop dementia, and they maybe have a spouse or a close relative who looks after them, being a church member may have been incredibly important to them throughout their lives. And yet sometimes we inadvertently place barriers in the way of those people still continuing to come to services, enjoying the fellowship, enjoying the coffee time afterwards, because it's not so easy sometimes when people's behavior is erratic. We may have a service at the wrong time of day. It's very difficult to get someone up and washed and dressed and travel to church in order for a 9:30 service, which is my standard time in the village where I live, for example. That would be a real stretch for someone looking after someone with advanced dementia.
So we've sort of talked about what is dementia, but how does a person with dementia feel? I think we talked a little bit earlier about the sort of challenge of your identity, of you know, the fear around losing, well, I know who I am. How is that a challenge for the person who's suffering from it?
Well, who am I if I don't have my life story to hand, able to tell someone of what's made me the unique me that I am? And I imagine that causes a great deal of apprehension and fearfulness in people. And I think there's a difference between identity and personhood. Identity is our name, the sort of roles that we might have had in life, a housewife or a teacher or the boss of a local company or whatever that is. Once we develop quite advanced dementia and those titles are no longer ours, it's a valid question. Who am I now that I'm not X, Y, or Z? But the beauty of having a Christian faith is that our personhood remains intact. It's not so much who we are, but whose we are. I think the Archbishop of Canterbury has pointed that up. Do you remember when his parentage was a subject of headline news? And he said he'd come to terms with the fact that his identity and his personhood, in fact, is safe with God, because God never forgets who we are. So it's not so much who we are, but whose we are. We're God's children, and we're precious in his sight. We're made in the image of God. And that's what has to be reinforced, really, for someone who may be going through the trauma of beginning to realize their own forgetfulness and then having a diagnosis, with all the unfortunate stigma that can be attached to any form of mental health problem that one may have during life. And then, of course, there's the strain of seeing one's, if one's lucky enough to have a primary carer who's a spouse or a close relative, then watching the strain that is imposed on them, but then gradually losing that self-awareness. But for the carer, it's a 24-hour job. And the ways in which sometimes even your closest friends and associates may not know quite how to speak to you any longer. They don't know whether it's appropriate to invite you to the things that they used to invite you to before. They're rattled by behavioral changes that are unpredictable. All these things can contribute to you being ostracized. Even when people don't want to be doing it, it comes from a place of lack of their own understanding of the disease and their ability to try and put themselves in the shoes of the carer. And what would I like if I were in their place? Well, I'd like you to continue to chat to me, to invite me, to include me, to find me good company, and to bear with me, even though I may have extra caring responsibilities that make me tired, more irritable, more short-tempered, and I may withdraw. And that might not be because I want not to speak to you anymore. It's just because of the embarrassment and the sheer hard work of committing to being somewhere, going through with the social occasion, and actually all the time being on the qui vive, trying to make sure that your loved one is all right. Very hard to relax in those kind of social situations, I would imagine.
So that challenge for carers and for the person themselves brings us into the challenge of dementia for church community. Churches although we want to be welcoming, I imagine are often not very welcoming spaces for those with dementia. Let's talk a bit more about that. How can we do better? Or what do we just need to acknowledge is hard?
Well, I talked a little bit about the design of the building, just crossing the threshold. Let's think about what the welcome mat, if you like, is like. But it goes beyond that. I mean, it's lovely if hard pews occasionally can also be supplemented by soft areas where, if one's attention span isn't what it was, one can wander off and still have a squashy sofa or bean bags or comfy chairs with arms so that if you are older, you can heave yourself up if you've got mobility issues as well as living with a mental disorder. Lots and lots of things. I mean, nice, bright pew cards on the pews so that you know what you're in for that morning, up on a screen, just talk through what's going to be the kind of timetable. And then the carer can also decide, you know what, there's 20 minutes there or 10 minutes there when we can quickly nip out and go to the loo, if there is a loo. In older churches, not always the case. Or I can just take some downtime and go to the back and I'm not going to miss out on too much. When it comes to the sacraments, maybe taking communion, might it be possible for the minister to come to us rather than me risk having to walk all the way down the aisle with my spouse who may have dementia, who you know, might get distracted, or their gait might just make people feel, oh, is this person all right? Are they normal? Something's going on. And we are social beings, but we're also quite sort of wary of the other. Anything that's out of the ordinary or unpredictable can make us kind of, you know, freeze. And that's not what you want for your loved one. You want the whole process to be enjoyable, a time of fellowship and worship. And I think there are things we can do. First of all, in autumn, for instance, we've had awareness sessions so that people understand what being a dementia-friendly church is all about. That's for the wider congregation. So get everyone in there and say, right, let's talk about how we're going to be a dementia-friendly church. And also, really, really being friendly and smiley and genuinely kind to people, because the emotional awareness remains even when one's memory is severely impaired. We all know what it feels like, whether we're on the receiving end of somebody's kindness or their irritability. And that can really change the mood of a welcome or the time spent together in a congregation. And also, when we've received kindness, that kind of glow that we all get stays with someone with dementia. It can actually sort of echo on, resonate for minutes, if not hours later. So a smile and a handshake and a warm welcome can really set someone up for the rest of the day. And that's what we don't realize sometimes, just how key all of those sort of social interactions are. And I think the other lovely thing about worship is we use our whole bodies to worship. So there's a kind of choreography in the liturgy. So we stand up, we sit down, we kneel, we move about the church sometimes. Sometimes there's a procession, or there's a come up to light candles time, or there's a sort of interactive nature of a service, particularly if it's an all-age worship, with some props, with bright colours, with the visual cues and clues, which help people to really keep their attention focused up front. And that can help them to process quite simple themes. Often are the best that work with people with dementia. And they're the same sorts of things that work well with small children. But the key difference is that you don't want to be in any way patronizing to people, because there are moments of lucidity. These are people who have that muscle memory, who have moments of really plugging back into their memory of the times when they've received communion in the past and how meaningful it's been for them. But to remember that we worship with our whole bodies, and to still enable people to have the opportunity to use their bodies in ways that will enhance the quality of worship.
I think there's ways that we can enable people to regain their self-esteem or sense of worth. As you were saying, our personhood doesn't go away, and valuing the contribution of people who often may have had significant roles in church and now are sitting in the pew feeling a bit like, I wish I could contribute more. Can you think of ways that people with dementia can contribute and not just be sort of receivers always, but can give to others?
Absolutely. There's a wonderful booklet that Livability, the charity Livability, produced. This is it, called Travelling Together. And in it, there's a lovely anecdote, actually, of a daughter who goes to her father's care home. And one of the local members of a church has come to lead a service. And she tells the story that this chap up front is covered in tattoos. He's a real bloke, but he's so sincere about what he's doing and so humble. And her father really enjoyed this act of worship. And then at the end, the leader at the front said to her father, "Would you like to close in a prayer for us?" And she thought, "Oh, how's this going to go? Is he going to choose the right words to say? Is this going to be an embarrassing moment?" And on the contrary, her father was absolutely so in the moment and enjoying it so much that he wrapped up this period of worship with a lovely, sincere prayer that everybody in the room gained so much from. And, you know, I often think that the prayers of children and the prayers of people who are deep into dementia can sometimes have a purity and a simplicity about them that takes it like an arrow straight to God. And that was certainly the case in this little anecdote that's included in that booklet that really has absolutely everything you need in it if you're a church that wants to be more inclusive and accessible for people with dementia and a whole host of other conditions, of course,
as well. And as you say, it's about, you know, including people in the liturgy. It might be offering people to do readings or prayers, maybe in partnership, yes, with somebody else to make sure it's manageable, but including people, yeah, allowing people to talk, yeah, amongst each other, you know, in pews, they can turn to each other. It's valuing the contribution of each person, not just sort of a productive upfront contribution. And I think this is where a small church may have an advantage on a larger church, where we can be more flexible. We know people, we know their quirks and also their history, and we can honour that as we introduce them. We can create more understanding and appreciation, which you might not have that same opportunity in a bigger church where you've just got so many more people and so many more things to get through from the front.
Yes, and I think, you know, there's a tendency in the bigger churches to want to have a very slick, smooth kind of liturgy that all works with it, everything coming in at the right moment, all the pictures and then sound all coordinated brilliantly well. And that is good because, you know, we are children now of the television age, and we are so used to well-produced videos and packages and so forth. But you're right, there's a beauty in the very simple country churches too, where somebody with dementia is well known and understood, and everybody sort of reacts in a way like a cocoon around them. But offering people the opportunity to read the lesson certainly boosts self-esteem. And what's the worst that can happen? Somebody may get the words a bit muddled. They may have to stop and start again. But I've certainly seen in a number of churches where I worship, where somebody with dementia comes up with another person so that they can just point to the right place if they get in a muddle. But there again, there's something so affecting about everybody, all members of the body of Christ are involved and given equal value. And that speaks so much to the way in which God looks at us is the different way from the way we look at one another very often. We are much more judgmental, I'm sure, than God is. And you know, there is so much we can learn from people with dementia, their ability to live in the moment, for example, which is something that all meditation teaches you. And many of us find it very difficult to sit still and just be in the present moment, the gift of the present moment. And yet somebody with dementia, very often, that's all they've got, because the past is not the past as we would recognize it. No concept really of what the future is. They're living like a small child, deeply and presently in the here and now.
It's beautiful. It is a gift, although we don't often think of it as a gift, but it is a gift, and we need that reframing. One of the things we've highlighted a few times in this conversation is the power of sort of intergenerational. There is this idea that as we get very old, we become like children again, but there is such power in the generations together, not just the very young and the very old, but all the generations together. I know Roots produces quite a lot of resources for intergenerational ministry. But let's talk about how intergenerational ministry, all age services, really do help those people who are suffering with dementia, but also their families and us to receive from them.
Well, one of the things that I did in autumn when I first started was to try and get more visits to care homes from the primary schools. And we did that in a very careful way. In other words, I would visit the group of primary school children who had been designated as, you know, your team's going to go in. Often we'd link it to Mothering Sunday or a particular season in the church calendar. And I would prepare those children. So with their teachers, I'd talk about what a care home is like and what they were likely to expect when they got there, the sorts of conditions that people would be in, and what conversations they could have, what conversation starters would work well. So we prepared the way, and then we made sure that those visits went well, that there were volunteer classroom assistants on hand and that the care assistants all knew what was going on. But there was such a value in getting young and old together in that way. And the older people I know enjoyed it so much, not least because they would stroke a beautiful soft cheek, or they'd look into the eyes of a young child and say, "My, the whites of your eyes are so fresh and new, they're almost blue." You know, so there was a real sense of enjoyment of being in one another's company. And likewise for the youngsters, they were able to ask questions like, "What, you know, what was your childhood like? What were your favorite toys when you were a little girl?" And some of the stories were great. They, you know, somebody would say, "Oh, my favorite was a wooden top." And you know, they'd think, "Well, what's a wooden top?" And they'd describe it. And for children who are so used to high-tech, stimulating toys, things that beep and buzz and move and fly and all these things, they couldn't believe the simple toys that they had in those kind of wartime days, and sometimes just before the war in those, you know, for some people who were of a real age. But in terms of church services, you're right. I think there's a real power in getting young and old to worship together. In Alton, again, we were lucky at one stage to have for 1 year, the oldest man in the world was living in Alton. Bob was 112 when he died, and he got into the Guinness Book of Records as the oldest man in the world. And Bob was regularly invited to local schools who were doing the Victorian age. You know, he was the closest thing to a Victorian, a living, breathing, walking, almost an Edwardian. He was born in 1907, after all, Bob. He had a new hip, incidentally, at the age of 106.
Incredible.
I knew him from 102 to 112, and it was during lockdown that I took his funeral service. And everybody at the crematorium all lined up to salute him as he, his body, his cortege came through. So it was remarkable to know Bob. And I know that there were so many youngsters who, he was a celebrity, of course, because he was the oldest. You know, that's almost, you know, once you've got a label like that, if you're just a mere 98 or 100, you know, people almost don't take any notice these days because it's become so commonplace. But to have a worship service that works for somebody who's four and somebody who's 104, now there's a real art to that. And that's what your website is all about, all the different ideas that you give for different age groups. And when I look at the ones for all age worship, they really do work well for older people as well as for the youngsters who might be the priority. Because when you see an all age service advertised, you can guarantee that, you know, that's children friendly. What we tend to think less is it'll work really well for older people with cognitive disabilities as well. And something else we've done in autumn, but it happens right across the network now because we share all these ideas in our training, is to have, for example, a tea service. So an early to mid-afternoon service, which works really well in terms of being a good time of day when people are going to be at their most alert. You don't have to rush to get them up and dressed in the morning. It's short, simple, familiar Bible stories, lots of singing because people love to sing. And often singing and music draws on a part of the brain or parts of the brain that are less damaged, injured by the brain disorders that we've been describing. So there's a friendliness, and people are intentionally crafting a service for that age group and their carers. And we also in autumn, for example, have forget-me-not services. The flower of the forget-me-not is the logo for the Alzheimer's Society. It's long been associated with dementia. And indeed, there's a book, Thinking of You, which is one of the books that BRF has produced. You can see the forget-me-nots on the front cover there. This one is by Joanna Collicutt, A Resource for the Spiritual Care of People with Dementia. Again, chock full of ideas of ways in which one can incorporate and involve people with dementia in worship and in community life generally.
So tell me more about this forget-me-not service. So it's mid-afternoon, yeah?
Yeah. We have experimented with times of day, but early to sort of, 3 o'clock is a great time, and it can always end with tea, which is a bonus, lots of cake and good time, social time together. Again, we think about the choreography of it so that there's the ability to bring someone up to the front and light a candle. We might remember somebody who, a loved one who's died, so to hold it around All Souls, All Saints, All Souls, that sort of time in the autumn, a time of a natural time of remembrance, but also to think about people who feel that they've forgotten their own histories to some extent. So it's honouring whatever memory remains, but also it's as if the community gathers around such people and is holding the memories for them. So they're very affecting services, and you can incorporate, say, toddler groups in those services as well, so that they're an all-age experience and young mums can be encouraged to bring their younger children to a service at that time of day, which works for everybody. And we try and advertise them so that they're across the different denominations, so that it really does incorporate people in the town who don't necessarily think church is for them. If it's a fundraising type service, they might well come and support it and buy cakes or produce at a stall afterwards, so that it becomes a proper community event. And we've also held, and now I show other people how to craft in celebration of age services. Sometimes we call it the silver service, I think is a nice way of describing it too. And I remember once, so the very first one we held in autumn, it grew out of the group of people who we got to know at lunch club that was held at the Methodist Church. And we also decided to hold this service at the Methodist Church. And as people arrived, I was there greeting with others at the door. And a lovely lady called Ruby came in with her friend, who was not a churchgoer. And she looked up at the screen and saw "in celebration of age." And she turned to her friend. I heard her say, "What's to celebrate?" And I thought, oh no, this is going to be an uphill struggle. But it was very funny because we had a lovely service and a lovely tea. And on the way out, Ruby shook my hand very genuinely. And she said to me, "Do you know what? I leave here a foot taller." And I just thought, thank heavens, job done. Because what it had done for Ruby is got her across the threshold of a church. And she'd found that she'd really enjoyed it, that there were lots of people who were in the same boat. It's not much fun sometimes growing old in the 21st century. But if you feel you're doing it alongside other people, and that people are there celebrating the fact that you've survived this long, first of all, that's to be celebrated, but also that you have so much to contribute, and that actually we're all the richer for hearing the life experiences and the memories and the points of view of people who have lived long and experienced much.
Yes, I think that attitude of gratitude and appreciation of really celebrating the people that we have while we can, rather than waiting until it's too late, letting them hear our appreciation. Yeah. I think that's beautiful. And I love that idea. So I think you've got some easy guides on your website. If people want to run these forget-me-not services or the celebration of age, how do they find those easy guides?
Well, I've just written and completed, I think the proofreading is now happening, for an easy guide, which is just a couple of sides of A4 on a lot of different topics, but this one specifically on holding an in celebration of age service, those kind of services that are geared specifically for older people. And so the beauty of it is that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. Somebody's already thought about it and decided what are the key top tips. And they're free to download, these easy guides. So if you go to the website and look under resources, there's a drop down that will show you easy guides. And we've been building up a real library of these. So we've got, for example, other topics that come to mind are how to involve schools in the work of and life of a care home. So how to kind of buddy school and care home together. How to pray with someone who's terminally ill. How to be with people at the end of life. Again, it's a top topic that people ask for more and more training on. It doesn't come naturally, or we feel it's not going to come naturally. In actual fact, it's much easier to do the than one might expect, and one shouldn't be put off by the thought of one's own mortality. Of course, people tend to veer away from any discussion of death and dying because it's uncomfortable for some people. But in actual fact, as we get older, we want people to talk to us about death and dying because it's a much more real and imminent thought for them. And very often families fail their loved ones by batting the topic away. Even when grandmother or grandfather might want to talk about it, they might say, inadvertently say, your age is away from that. Oh, no, you know, you're looking great. Don't bother thinking about that. Don't be morbid. But it's not a question of being morbid. These are realities that people want someone who's kind and a good listener to really help them think through and to prepare for.
I know my dad was in hospice last year and passed away about this time last year, actually, a few days ago last year. And I, as a carer, really benefited from all the people who came and prayed with him, who sat with him, who encouraged him, and who just weren't afraid to talk about the big issues. So I do think there's skill in it, but it's so important and mattered to him, but also to us as his family being with him in those days.
Completely. And then for the person who's at the focus of everyone's attention, you know, that's hugely reassuring for them that people are treating it naturally. It's a natural part of life. Death is part of life. And yet we've become such a death-denying society. That's the problem. So knowing where to start and having a couple of sides of A4 that just give you a real sense of how anybody can do this, it's not difficult. It's just you need a little bit of guidance and a bit of tact and diplomacy in the process.
So one thing I want to come on to is this, that there's a whole load of ways that we can support people who are elderly. Churches are full of fantastic community, people who want to get around and support and look after people who'll pop in and visit. There are some cautions that we want to offer, or maybe just some awareness raising of some of the safeguarding challenges, or even just some do's and don'ts as you're trying to support people. So you might be listening to this podcast and thinking, oh, I must go and check in on Auntie Mabel, or, you know, that woman who used to come to church and hasn't been for a while. I really should go and check up on her. What are some sort of do's and don'ts or some things that we want to flag up as people want to support those who are elderly in their community?
Well, I'm glad you've asked this, because very often safeguarding courses, which have become absolutely vital in across all the denominations now, and rightly so, tend to focus on children and vulnerable young people. And they don't so often mention vulnerable older people. So it's important to think of both ends of the age spectrum, as we've said. I think our advice for Anna chaplains is to follow the advice of one's own denominations. As we've said, there are many different denominations who are involved with Anna chaplaincy. So there are Anglicans, Methodists, Baptists, Catholics, pre-evangelical churches, URC, you name it. So each denomination will be giving a lot of thought to all of this, and there will be protocols. So it's important for each person who is a designated Anna chaplain or Anna friend to follow the advice of their own denominations. That's the first thing. When crafting the sorts of services that I've been talking about, it's important to think about the safeguarding aspect. And it's right, really, to make sure that the people who are likely to have the most hands-on experience with people, in other words, somebody might need to go to the lavatory, somebody might need a little bit of guidance if they're pulling their skirt up and you know, inappropriate behaviour that just needs to be sort of dealt with. It's best if somebody who has been DBS checked, in other words, they've got the kind of statutory paperwork in place, they've been trained, they've been checked with the Criminal Records Bureau and all of those kind of things, so that the right people are known. As so if there's a problem that crops up, you know, Debbie the Anna chaplain or John the Anna chaplain, could you help here? And if there is an incident when something happens, so say there's a small accident or there's some kind of incident, it's always important, safeguarding wise, to make a contemporaneous note. So write it down. If there's an accident, write it in the accident book for the church, and they're bound to have them, I'm sure. And make sure if you're in any doubt of a conversation you've had which has alerted you to some sort of risk around this person's life, that you refer up. So explain why you've just got a bit of an uneasy feeling about somebody following a conversation you may have had with them, or something that they confided to you and you didn't know quite what to do with the confidence that they gave to you. Refer up, because that's the safeguarding protocol for pretty much everybody, is make sure that if you've got some kind of concern, that you flag it up to someone who is more senior than you. So those are important tips. In terms of lone working and setting boundaries, if you're a pastoral visitor, often pastoral visitors will go in pairs, or if it's the tradition of that church that you go on your own. Again, if anything happens or you're told something that you feel is important and significant and you need to share it with someone, share it with your line manager, your minister, so that somebody else is brought into the circle. And if somebody is telling you, say, a confession of some sort of abuse that they've carried out themselves, that is an illegal act that they are telling you about. And you are duty bound to make sure that you tell somebody about it. There are key moments in exchanges between people where confidentiality no longer applies. And that's one of the key ones. If somebody is saying that actually they've been an abuser and you have some doubt about whether they may still be abusing others who are in their circle, then you are duty bound to flag that up to somebody and appropriate steps will ensue. So it's not to scare people, because, you know, the vast majority of people who wish to help with the older age group are never going to encounter any of these difficulties. But if they do, then they need to know where they go for help and advice. And that's the key thing. And particularly anybody who is putting their head above the parapet, if you like, and becoming an Anna chaplain or a volunteer Anna friend. It'll form part of their training, but they will also be properly line managed by somebody within the church in which they're embedded. Every Anna chaplain is accountable to and is authorized by their local church. They may work among people who have no particular religious affiliation. And indeed, about 50% of those encounters that they have are likely to be, according to our surveys, with people who never do go to church. They're in the wider community, but they're in that age group, or they are a carer who needs additional support. So one isn't to be put off going into this sort of ministry by some of the things that I've talked about, but it's as well to be aware of the kind of frameworks that exist to make sure that all of this is done in as safe and professional a way as possible.
Because I think as good Christians, we often want to look out for our neighbours or people on our street, and we might pop in and go, oh, are you all right? We need to be cautious about things like taking some cash from them and buying things from the corner shop. Again, finance can be a big issue, especially if they're quite forgetful. You know, did that money come back? Should I do it? And we just want to say, don't do those kind of things. If you're going to buy something, buy it out of your own money. And don't touch anything that belongs to them in terms of finances. And again, it's just trying to make sure that relatives, the key carers and relatives, are the ones who are making those decisions. Often, as we talked about before, you can end up with elderly people who are quite far away from their family, and they come to church and tell you about stuff that's going on, and you want to step in and help them, you want to get involved, but we don't want to alienate those family members. So Anna chaplains would be trained in all of this. Us, as being good neighbors, we might end up just sort of stepping over those boundaries unintentionally and very well meaningly, but we need to be careful that we're not actually causing more problems than we're trying to help with.
Yeah, I think that's very good advice, and never put oneself in jeopardy by however much somebody might say, oh, do take my card to the local shop and use it to, you know, tap and go, or to, could you get me some cash out? No, leave that to their closest relatives, and you can never then be accused of any kind of financial abuse or coercion of any sort. So it's just using your common sense not to lay yourself open to criticism or some sort of accusation. Much safer to err on the side. And if somebody is hungry and they need food, just buy it yourself, or at least talk to the local church and say, you know, can I get some food bank vouchers for this person, because they really are in need. So there are ways of doing it much more safely than actually using cash or borrowing money from people.
So
we've gone down quite a heavy road,
but I guess these are some of the big issues that do face people who are lonely or living their own, are vulnerable. But coming back to this vision of hope, of pastoring people in their later life and appreciating all that they've got, that they can bring to us, but also helping them live flourishing spiritual and emotional lives. I'm sure you want more people to get involved with Anna Chaplaincy. Tell me more about the vision of what you want to do there.
Well, I would dearly love to see Anna Chaplaincy becoming as synonymous with good spiritual care as, say, Macmillan nurses are for good cancer care. I hope and pray that one day Anna Chaplaincy will be available in every medium-sized community across the land. And we've got pilots now of where that is actually happening. Take Portsmouth Diocese, for example. Not just Anglicans, but others of other denominations, Methodists and so forth, in Southampton and the Isle of Wight, are now really developing Anna Chaplaincy in a very strategic, rolled-out way. Because the Bishop of Portsmouth, Jonathan Frost, has said he wanted to have Anna Chaplaincy available in every parish, what we're doing is we've done bespoke training weekends for Anna chaplains and Anna friends. Others have been on the online training that you've mentioned. We've now got 60 Anna chaplains and Anna friends trained up in a year. So this is really starting to happen. It's happening elsewhere in the country too. Cumbria has had a wonderful tradition of enabling churches to be dementia friendly, having dementia enablers. And when that pilot project came to a close, churches together in Cumbria took on Anna Chaplaincy as their next push, really, to enhance the lives of all older people, not just people with dementia. And there's, again, been a lot of training going on, and we've got a regional coordinator paid for by Churches Together in Cumbria. And that's what the pattern seems to be that's developing now, that the areas of the country where we're seeing the biggest growth are where there are paid and indeed in some cases volunteer coordinators. Rochester and Canterbury Diocese in Kent, which cover the fringes of South London as well. In Newcastle and Cumbria and in Wales and in the West Country based in Devon. So those are the kind of hotspots, and we're now getting our first Anna chaplains in Scotland. So we've got our first Church of England and Scottish Episcopal Church Anna chaplains. So this little idea that began by me responding to a job advert we don't know what it's going to look like, but we think it's a good idea to have a chaplain for older people idea in Alton, has grown since 2014 to this extent to 358 Anna chaplains and their equivalents across the country, plus those typically 5 to 8 volunteers, some of whom are known as Anna friends, who are working alongside them. So we're now talking about over 500,000 encounters a year with older people and carers. And, you know, you start to see how that can be amplified all over the country. And suddenly we'd have a real force of people who would be enhancing the lives of older people and crucially giving people who've got so much to offer the opportunities to contribute. Because I don't know whether you heard Joan Bakewell on the Today programme the other day. It was a very short interview at the end. She's become something of a spokeswoman for older people. She's 90 now. She sounds still so young and is so full of energy. And she was really lamenting the fact that we write people off too early. And Bob would say this. Bob, at the age of 112, said, I had to retire in my 60s, but I could easily have carried on another 10 years or more. People have so much to offer, and age shouldn't be a barrier to go on contributing to our families, our communities, our churches, and to the wider conversation of what it is to be human.
Well, I know
across all ages.
I have been blessed by many people in their later years, and often they are the backbone and the key volunteers in churches across the country. So we couldn't be without them. And we do really, really appreciate them. And I want to thank you for this incredible ministry that you have been obedient and followed through. And 10 years, that's some pretty good work to bring it up to 358 Anna chaplains and nearly, what did you say, 500,000 encounters across the country. It's just beautiful. And I know God is using it.
Yeah. Well, it's all thanks to BRF Ministries, who took on the risk, if you like, and took us on. And Richard Fisher, my boss, the CEO of BRF Ministries, and my successor, Debbie Duseal, who's now heading up this ministry. We're a tiny team, and we need more funds to keep that engine of growth going. It's a struggle sometimes to get the money to pay for this core team that's helping to train people. Julia Burton-Jones is developing the training courses all the time. And as I say, there's no shortage of people wanting to come forward to be Anna chaplains and Anna friends. What we do need is the funds to keep that core team going at BRF, based in Abingdon, but as everybody does, we all work remotely from home these days. But without that central heartbeat, if you like, this growth would not have happened. So, you know, if you're a prayer, then pray that the resources will come to enable us to keep this level of growth continuing, because there's really, you know, the sky's the limit in terms of the impact that could have on successive generations and changing our attitudes to what it is to be old, to a point where we really value everybody at every age and stage of their lives.
And if you're a giver, do give. And a chaplaincy would appreciate that support to grow this ministry.
We would.
Do really, really appreciate you, Debbie. It's been fantastic talking with you. And I will give people lots of websites and details of places to go shortly. But I just want to say thank you and really appreciate your time.
For a lovely opportunity. And thank you so much. And I do hope that people really read the books and get the booklets. And you're never starting from scratch with this. There's lots of help out there. It's just knowing where to find it. And that's what you're providing. So thank you for that.
Thank you. For easy guides to connecting with care homes, schools, running Messy Vintage, a form of messy church adapted for older people, dementia cafes and the forget-me-not service Debbie mentioned earlier, please head to the Anna Chaplaincy website, annachaplaincy.org.uk. They also offer a training course to become an Anna Chaplain. It's Zoom-based training that happens over 6 2-hour sessions. Train as a subject specialist. And with small cohorts of no more than 14 people, you'll have loads of interaction. Guest Anna chaplains also contribute. The course is available to those who are supported by their local church in taking on a role as an Anna chaplain. It costs £148, including the handbook, which provides all your essential reading on the topic. To find out more, head to the Anna Chaplaincy website and click Training and Support. Be sure to read Julie Burton-Jones' article on dementia-friendly church in Roots Adult Knowledge magazine, issue 132, out in July-August 2024. You can find it on our website as well, rootsforchurches.com. Roots publish weekly materials for intergenerational ministry, preaching and worship. And as you heard, our all-age resources are fantastic for including people with dementia. Our resources are ordered around the Revised Common Lectionary and help you engage heart, mind, and body in your worship. Thanks for listening.